Today's podcast features Jorge Santana, the executive director of Pace Career Academy Charter School in Pembroke, New Hampshire, and is a JFYNet partner school. In this episode, you'll hear how Mr. Santana was an at-risk student while growing up.
I was attending the TYP program. I actually left maybe like 2 months in. Mr. Williams would, this is before cell phones, right? So he kept calling New York on the emergency numbers I had left.
Worked early in his career to find systemic solutions to help students connect with mentors.
Adolescent, maybe like a couple of months after they had aged out of the system and they were panhandling, like maybe two blocks away from the office. And that really didn't sit well with me.
And from Pace Academy students, Sarah and Troy.
You definitely get the help. You don't get homework here.
Kind of, we have a lot of one-on-one time. We're seen as like more as people instead of just regular students.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of remote learning programs to schools, students, and parents. JFY's individualized self-paced curricula help raise individual and school performance measures by maintaining grade-level skills and combating learning loss. JFY provides online ELA and math curricula aligned to state and college standards from grade 6 through high school, with personal support online and via telephone from friendly instructional coaches like yours truly. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Pace Career Academy Charter School works with students who are often considered at risk by other school districts. Mr. Santana can relate to students who struggle with education due to other factors in their lives.
So I think for me, school, when I think back of school, I remember moving around a lot. Always felt like I was like the new kid in the school. So I've gone to school in Puerto Rico. I went to school in New York. I went to school in Waltham. So between those three kind of locations, I kept moving around a lot. I made it until about the 10th grade in Waltham High School. And I ended up moving back to New York. My mom was ill, and I went back to a year in high school in Spanish Harlem. I was having a really hard time finding work and be able to do anything like that. And I moved back to Waltham. And when I went back to the high school, they told me that since I had left, that I couldn't go back. I didn't know that that was a real thing or that you couldn't do that. So I just left, got a couple of jobs and just started working. I found out about jobs for youth through my best friend's, at the time girlfriend, now wife. She had graduated first through the program. And my friend Lance told me that, hey, well, Avita graduated this program. She really liked it. And me and him decided to enter the program together. And that's how I got introduced into the program. So we used to drive up and get rides from Waltham. We were both living in Waltham still at the time. And we would go to downtown to the on-site location they had then. So I went there to get my GED. And it was taking classes. So we were there. We used to get some support around the different subject material for each one of the tests. And it was just really about preparing us to be able to take the test. You know, I remember the staff being very, very supportive. And I remember being pushed and held accountable, but also getting the support that I needed to be able to kind of meet the bar that they had set for us. So between maybe like 6 months, maybe 8 months to be able to finish the program. And graduated from the program, had the honor of being a valedictorian of the class. And we got to give a speech at the State House. I remember we had the graduation at the State House. So it was really, really neat. I remember my grandmother and my mom got to come and actually see the graduation, which has been a few times that I've got to see my grandmother cry out of joy. You know, that was one of the times. So it's really nice. Waltham at the time when I got to the high school, I had these just memories. And, you know, one of them is me on like the first day of class walking to, I had gotten into an AP history class, and the teacher had said to me without any malice at all, you know, said to me, I think you're in the wrong class, before I even got into the door. I felt that while I was there, all of the students who looked like me kind of got sent to the basement to shop, to the shop classes. And, you know, I was just also struggling. I had a lot of stuff outside of school that I was dealing with at home in different pieces. And I just wasn't, school wasn't a support for me. I didn't really feel like anybody there was invested. And that was kind of the experience that I had. That being said, I also do remember a science teacher who gave up their lunch period to teach me a science class, just me and her, because of me refusing to now go back to that other AP class. So I would say that it's like, for me, high school, I remember these really high and lows. And, you know, for me, school wasn't something that it was expected of me, like to go on to college or anything like that. That thought or language or idea just wasn't discussed around me. So I didn't see the need or the importance, I guess, at the time mm-hmm. of being able to needing to be able to graduate. For me, my most immediate concerns were where I was living, if I had food, what I was wearing, and that was what I was addressing at the moment. I did move back. I went to Puerto Rico when I was to school till about the second grade, I think third grade, and I moved to the Bronx. I grew up there. So English, you know, English was my dominant language by the time I came back. So yeah, but it was a challenge when I first got, you know, going from a school in Puerto Rico to the Bronx was a big change for me as well. For me, at first it was a lot more communal, right? So school's a lot smaller. You knew everybody that was there. You knew their families because they were all from the same kind of neighborhood that you were there. To just going somewhere where I felt like, you know, it was a small city. And, you know, that was kind of, I think, the more jarring thing that stuck out to me.
One thing that helped Mr. Santana succeed was a personal connection with an adult who not only helped with his studies, but kept pushing him to finish his studies.
So I was working in restaurants during that time. And by happenstance, somebody on the board of JFY, Jobs for Youth at the time, had a connection to Brandeis University. And there was a program there. It was a transitional year program. And that's how I was connected to that program. And through that program, I met a gentleman, Tony Williams, who used to run that program. And he was really the one who kind of took over that support that I was getting from Jobs for Youth and that kind of encouragement and that persistence of needing to finish. So I actually had, my mom got sick again. And the first year that I was attending the TYP program, I actually left maybe like 2 months in. Mr. Williams this is before cell phones, right? So he kept calling New York on the emergency numbers I had left and was trying to get me to come back. One of my kind of favorite stories with him is that, so he was not getting through to me, not responding to him. So he found a female student that he knew I had been interested in before I left and got her to start calling. And he got a hold of me again. And I was able to come back to the program. And when I came back the following year, that's the year that that I finished the transitional year program. I had the option to go to, I could have applied to any other school. But I, again, because of that relationship that I had, I stayed there. The TYP stands for a transitional year program. And what it was a program, and it's still there, is a program that's really targeted at young people like myself at the time who had this kind of not traditional path through education. And it was a way to really be able to enhance where I was at and get me to the level of college work. And that's how I was able to get introduced to go to college. Now, I remember when I first started going there, I couldn't work as much and I was actually homeless and I was living in a shelter. And the director of the program calls me into his office and, you know, he's like, "Are you living in a shelter?" And I'm like, "Yes." And he said, "You know, we have dorm rooms here." And I just, you know, I think back at times like that. And that was like such a new concept to me. And he was able to get me into a dorm room. And those were the kind of pieces that removing those type of barriers is, and being creative on how to do it, I feel it, you know, has really guided me to the way that I do my work now. Those are the things that I look back and I draw upon that informs the way that I work with the young people now. I feel like a lot of that I tripped by luck, right? So Jobs for Youth was because a friend of mine's girlfriend at the time got there. You know, I had this board member from that program. And I thought that if this random kid like me could find those pieces kind of by luck, there has to be a systemic way to be able to catch those young people and be able to help them succeed. I had just thought that, honestly, like, you know, whoops, I messed up. I had that opportunity and I messed it up and didn't really want to, and just thought that, you know, since I had messed it up, that I wouldn't be able to go back and that I wouldn't be able to do it. Mr. Williams did not, he thought otherwise. So after Brandeis, my first job that I got out of Brandeis was at this organization called My Turn. And it was a similar, it was a GED program and working with reentry and young people that were at high risk. I had dropped out and I partnered with an organization called, working within an organization called ROCA. And this is back when this new programming around starting businesses within these nonprofits to then have young people work within them, kind of when that really started picking up. But what they were finding were that young people not only needed the hard skills, but a lot of the soft skills as well. So I kind of came in to do a lot of the soft skills pieces to complement the work.
Not only does Mr. Santana understand the importance of teaching students academic skills, but also teaching soft skills, which include interacting with other people.
So one of my favorite stories, so, you know, we had this young person who we taught how to work on a cash register, how to be able to balance their checkbook, how to be able to, you know, kind of know about how much taxes they're going to take out, how to fill out a job application, all those different pieces. But on the first day of the job, this young person saw another young person that they didn't get along with and got into this huge shouting match in the middle of the store. And the young person lost their job the next day. And it was like this light bulb moment where you need to be able to do both. So that was kind of where that came from. And I did that work. And I actually, from there, I moved to the Department of Social Services. Now it's DCYF. Mm-hmm. And I worked there. First started working, when I first came there, I told the director that I just work with adolescents. That's what I do. And of course, like a good director, he gave me nothing but toddler cases. And he put me in a domestic violence unit. So that's where I started my work, which is great. It kind of expanded my skills. It also, when I stopped caring about my car, because I learned really quickly that having a bunch of toddlers in your car just does not bode well. I did that work. And while I was there, I started to gravitate back to adolescents who were very high risk. And especially with young people that had already been identified as young people that were pretty much going to be in foster care until they aged out. And I remember seeing this one adolescent, maybe like a couple of months after they had aged out of the system, and they were panhandling like maybe two blocks away from the office. And that really didn't sit well with me. So I started doing kind of a little bit digging and found that the results for that population were just atrocious countrywide. So I was able to, through school, I had started attending my master's program at this point as well. But I was able to start a unit with my manager at the time, and we called it the Connections Unit. And it was specifically targeting that population and approaching different techniques and styles and really changing some of the rules of how to reach out and engage to that population. And the really model was based around like harm reduction. So really seeing that some of the policies that the state had put in place, though it was protecting the state, it was actually raising the risk of some of the students. So I did that, and that was the last, you know, kind of big project where I was at within the state before I left. I left the state because I had actually, it was taking a 3-year, doing a 3-year master's program, Boston College. I decided to go to Boston College because Mr. Williams had told me that he felt that Boston College wasn't diverse enough. So again, you know, I had no idea of these things, and it was really more just the relationship that I had with him. So I decided to go to BC. I applied and was accepted and did a 3-year program. The state at the time had a program for employees that you were actually able to continue to get your full salary while you attended school, as long as you promised to stay twice as long as the time that you took. So the first 2 years of the 3-year program, I took the minimal classes because my plan was that the final year, I was just going to go to school full time. That I graduated in 2010. So 2008 was when the economy crashed. And then 2009 was that last year I was supposed to take. And that was like the first program that the state got rid of when they started making all of the cuts. So I was kind of left in this position of I either drop out of my program, you know, or stay working full time. So I decided to finish the program there at BC. And that's how I transitioned out of the state. But I would have probably stayed there. That was kind of my plan and my goal. The reason why I went to go get my master's was because that's the only way that you could become a supervisor within the state. So that's how I moved into the master's program. And then my last year that I was at BC, I actually did a lot of work on raising the awareness of DSS at the time as a career path. You know, it was kind of like a family member. You know, I used to complain about it, but I was working in it. And when I got to BC, I felt that the program and everybody was always very, very hard on the department. And I found that they were actually discouraging people who would actually go into the system and actually probably could make it a lot better. So I worked on this conference, and I was able to set up this conference where I had, you know, from social workers all the way up to area program managers. And I brought some youth too who had aged out of the system, and had a big conference at BC. And I got to get an award from the school for that, called the Sister Thea Bowman Award, I think it was. But it was really nice to be able to get that recognition. And, you know, it was nice to kind of get some of my classmates who at first were thinking that that was the worst possible place you could go to work, to actually kind of think about it as an option.
Working as a social worker with educational nonprofits seemed to be a calling until the opportunity to form and transform a school from the ground up came along. And it was the last thing he ever expected to be doing after earning his master's degree.
So that was my last year at BC. And if you would have asked me 2 years ago if I would be running a school, I would have probably told you that, yeah, your mind wasn't all there. It was the furthest thing I was planning from doing. So I've always worked with schools because of the families and young people, and school is always a big part of that. But I have never worked for a school, and I was not planning on running a school. Kind of once I got to that point, my dream and goal was actually came up with a whole business plan and all this. And I had an organization that I called The Other Half, which was like my final project when I was finishing up at BC. And I thought that I was going to start my own nonprofit and wanted to be able to run my own nonprofit. That was kind of my goals when I got there. So I went from that kind of mindset to be able to move into figuring out from the state, working for the state. Once I had gone out, I had gone through the school and learned more about macro kind of social work. And something else that I learned a lot too while I was in the state is that I kind of felt like a revolving door. And I went from wanting to do direct work to wanting to really think about how do I design systems that are able to provide better outcomes. Stop me if you heard it. I've had this terminology that was told to me. That's always stuck with me. You have two social workers in a canoe. One of them is a clinical social worker. The other one's a macro social worker. And a baby comes floating down. The clinical social worker picks up the baby, makes sure it's warm, checks its, make sure that it's being able to respond correctly. And a few minutes later, another baby comes floating by. Clinical social worker does the same thing. After a while, the canoe starts to fill up with babies. The macro social worker jumps in and swims upstream to figure out where all the babies are coming from. And for me, that's the type of work that I wanted to do, was figure out how can I have more of an impact than dealing with one young person at a time. So that kind of switched my mind, and I started then looking at, I want to start my own nonprofit organization that I can start to do that. I started going in, kind of found a niche for finding very interesting models that were unique, but were struggling at the time. One of the first organizations that I went to after I finished up was an organization in Lowell. It's actually called UTEC. And at the time, they were starting to expand, and they were really trying to develop their case management system. So I had gone up there and helped them set that up. From there, I moved to another organization that was actually in Jamaica Plain. And before that, I worked at a union for a year. And in the union, they were separate, but it was a small nonprofit that provided English classes and citizenship classes to union members. So being able to expand the services and outreach to not just a specific members, but also looking at how do we integrate, you know, their family members as well. So I did that for a year. That was in downtown. And from there, then I went to an organization that was 12-year mentoring organization. So they identified children in kindergarten, observed for a few weeks, and depending on different risk factors, selected a cohort of students, which then they matched with a one-on-one professional mentor who spent, the goal was 16 to 20 hours a month. And they would follow that young person and work with that young person all the way through high school graduation. When I got there, an issue they were having was, since the young people were in the program for so long, once they hit like their middle school years, they felt that the program was for little kids, and they started to lose a lot of their cohorts. So they brought me on board to design an adolescent program for them, and to be able to re-engage all of those young people and families back. Yeah. So when I finished, my last organization was an organization that had young people start their own businesses in the ninth grade. And I helped them with some of the same kind of restructuring with programming, staffing, things like that. So once I finished up that job, I decided that I wanted to start looking at executive director roles. I had always been, you know, program director, site director, those type of things, and started looking for an executive director role. I, by happenstance, a friend of mine owns a vacation home up in the White Mountains, and I had gotten out of a relationship. You know, I asked if she wanted to keep the apartment or not. She said she wanted to keep it. So me and my dog Gizmo, we stayed up at my friend's house in Thornton. And I was going back to Boston. I mean, the whole time I was looking and interviewing in Boston. And I think just because of location, this school popped up. And I made the mistake of looking into it and then coming to interview here. Just not expected. That's how I kind of ended up here.
Remembering what worked for him when he was a student, Pace Academy helps their students find success by keeping both class sizes and the overall population of the school low. and providing support to students not just for their academic courses, but for their lives outside of the school as well.
So I think the number one thing is just, A, its size. So we focus on the schools will not get bigger than 60 students. And I think that the other piece is our ability to be able to individualize education. So we, because of our sizes, have very small class sizes. We're able to integrate a lot more project-based learning. And we also integrate workforce readiness, which includes internships, job exposure, and different pieces in that sense. That's kind of the core of the school. And then what we've been developing as well is realizing and understanding the whole child, and that our young people need more support sometimes than just the academic piece. And we've been able to set up a structure here that we're able to provide, go out into the community and support our young people in the community as well. And we run groups here, life skills groups, you know, ranging anything from conflict resolution to handling relationships to being able to, you know, work on a budget. And again, the being able to individualize what each student needs is what sets us apart. I feel that all youth are at risk, especially adolescents. And I think that it just resources can mitigate that risk. And one thing that I did find in New Hampshire is that resources are sparse. I now know why there's no taxes up here. But with no taxes comes no support. There's no public transportation, you know, a lot of those pieces. When I came up here, the demographics are very different than what I was used to working with. And I honestly, when I remember when I first walked in to meet all of the students here, I was like, they're not going to get my jokes. Like, they're not going to be able to understand. And that wasn't the case at all. I felt like I knew them. I knew what they were kind of going through and what they were struggling with. And that, you know, was one of, to me, those light bulb moments that made me realize that it's a lot to do with socioeconomic as well. And that, you know, a lack of resources, whether it's rural or inner city, plays out the same way. And, in some ways, I find it even more challenging in rural areas. You know, one of the biggest challenges I have right now is just transportation. I could get all of my young people amazing opportunities, but if they can't afford to get to the opportunities, then, we're not able to actually have them take advantage of them. What we're finding is that I get young people who come here for a variety of reasons, anywhere from not getting the necessary one-on-one attention that they need at their district schools, from being, you know, bullied and not feeling safe, to, you know, wanting to be able to have close relationships with the staff where they weren't able to get that at a bigger district school. And we have found that our young people are responding very well, and our families are also. You know, I think I see a lot of the times how draining, it's not just on the young people when their school placement's not working, but it's a big drain on the families as well. It raises stress and it causes a lot of conflict. And, you know, when the young person starts to respond very differently, I can just see the parents' like shoulders go down. It has this really positive effect on the whole kind of a family. Yes, I do think that our students are benefiting. When I started the school, I had about 18 students enrolled at the time. I ended the school year last year with a wait list for the first time in the history of the school. And right now I have a list of young people that are waiting to start with us on April 15th. And I'm sure that we'll end the school year this year with a wait list as well. There's definitely an awakening to the opportunity. And I think it was just due to lack of information and misinformation about what a charter school is and what can it provide.
Gary Kaplan, the executive director of JFY Networks, was an early mentor in Mr. Santana's life, and even during difficult moments, never gave up on their relationship.
Gary set me up one time to go live on Channel 7. to do an interview. And I, being an adolescent as I was actually in my early 20s, did not come through for Gary. And I was mortified to reach out to him and let him know that, you know, I mean, he obviously knew that I didn't show up, but he was really upset at me, with me, told me how upset he was with me, but never severed the relationship, right? You know, I guess didn't give up on me either, because I was reached out to again. And, you know, I've been lucky to have people like that. And, you know, those memories are really what has dictated the way that I approach the work, so.
Sarah and Troy are students at Pace Academy and discuss how they have found success with the help of Mr. Santana and all of the staff members at Pace.
It's an amazing school. You get a lot of help here when you need it. You definitely get the help. You don't get homework here.
It's kind of more, we have a lot of one-on-one time. We're seen as like more as people as just, instead of just regular students. It's more of like a personal experience. We feel more comfortable around the teachers. It's a lot easier to do our work that way.
Because the classes are a lot smaller. The high school I used to go to was a big high school, so when I was in class, I wouldn't get the help I needed because there were so many students around, so that if I needed help, I wouldn't get the help I needed, so my grades were like kind of dropping a lot. As when I came here, I got the help I needed a lot.
I got in trouble a lot at my old school. My grades were bad too, and then I was like, I'm going to try out this school. I didn't want to, but... Then after like the second day here, I was like, you know, I'm just going to stay. And now I've been here for like 3 years. They respect us. You know, they're willing to listen. He's trying his best. Yeah. He's definitely like, he's a very progressive director. Like he's, because we used to be in this, like you were there. We were at like this pretty low grade building. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't very good. It was, so he's definitely been working his butt off to make sure we can get the best resources we can.
Pace Academy is a partner of JFY Networks and has benefited from both the software we provide and the personal interaction by Eileen Wiedegartner, a blended learning specialist at JFY.
Now, I think one of the great feelings for me around the full circle piece is that now we get to work with JFY Networks in regards to being able to support my students here, especially with the math and English that has been, you know, a challenge for some of our students who have had a more non-traditional path. And also this year, helping us set up our eStart classes, which are our college level online classes, which is the first time that the school's ever had those. So it feels really good and makes me feel very old that I started moving from, you know, from a program where I got my GED from to now a program that's helping me in my work with young people. So they work with us with the platforms of MathSpace as well as Achieve 3000 and being able to help us only be able to further our personal mission of individualization for each one of our students. And both of those software systems really allows us to meet each student exactly where they're at and be able to work at their pace. And for us, it just aligns perfectly with our mission.
We would like to thank Jorge Santana and the students Sarah and Troy from Pace Academy for joining us on this month's podcast. We hope their experiences have provided insight to the success Pace Academy has had working with students holistically and not just academically. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. This has been a production of JFY Networks.